involved in riots in Iran by instigating the younger generation through social media to carry out acts of vandalism. The best way to counter this terrorist organization is to raise public awareness, and this is the main focus of the movie. Gisu Mishah Ahmadi, Tehran.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled.
Yeah.
Savings depleted.
Yeah.
Hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights.
Yeah.
And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries. This was a crisis made in Downing Street, and it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. Whereas with when they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area. Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra cost to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Saipur is up, London.
The Taliban's Ministry of Vice and Virtue have banned Afghan women from visiting all parks, using gyms and public baths.
Recently, women are banned from going to parks, sports clubs, and public baths by the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. For the past 15 months, the orders given to these places were violated and ignored. That's why now it is decided that they should be banned. It is not clear how long the restrictions would last or whether they are going to be lifted.
The famous city park in Kabul, once filled with families' joy and laughter, now has turned idle and silent, with only a handful of men wandering through the complex. The ban order has also affected the livelihoods of people who have been making ends meet by working at public places.
They are interrupting our livelihoods with their decisions. Now they have banned women, so less customers are visiting here. Look, it's in the middle of the day, but no visitors. I have rented a photography shop here, and I used to have an adequate income. But now the ban is making me close it down.
Women rights activists urge the Taliban to reverse its course on all women's rights, saying such decisions would provoke national outrage.
Instead of attempting to ban the doors of parks for women, the Taliban should manage to let Afghan boys and girls learn. They should address the economic and humanitarian crisis in the country rather than focusing on weird restrictions on women. I'm sure such decisions expose the reality of the Taliban and would face public anger.
The Taliban have already banned women from traveling without a male relative. Secondary schools for girls have also been shut for over a year across the country. Afghan women are worried about being barred from public places after the authorities announced the new restrictions. The women are now calling for justice, demanding the authorities protect their rights. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Shah-e-Darab, a week-long exhibition in Indian-administered Kashmir is displaying dozens of rare manuscripts written by prominent poet Khwaja Muhammad Amin Darab. The language was once officially used in courts and commerce until 1889. The organizers say the aim of the event is to revive Persian language in the region. About 73 manuscripts, including a dozen books written by Darab, are on display.
Persian is so deeply entrenched that you can't think of our craft without Persian. You can't think of Kashmiri language, forget about Persian, without Persian language. You can't think of our basic ethical and sacred knowledge without Persian.
Persian is what Kashmir is all about. And it still has a resonance in contemporary Kashmiri society. If you go to any urs or any major shrine of Kashmir, the manqabat and the naats that are recited will be jami, they will be in Persian.
Chronogram on Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon, Maharaja of Kashmir's accession to the throne in 1923, elegies of prominent scholars, including on the death of Muslim scholar and jurist Maulana Anwar Shah Kashmiri, are being displayed in the exhibition. Darab was instrumental in transmitting traditional Persian literature in the region. He is also known as a master of Kitah-e-Tarikh and Naats in the praise of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Darab died in 1979 in Srinagar, but his memories and writings continue to enlighten hearts and minds in the region. The remnants of Persian verses are widely recited in mosques, shrines, Sufi, and spiritual gatherings. The Persian language reached its peak in Kashmir during the Mughal rule, but faded with the course of time. The exhibition organizers say events like this are an ideal platform to revive Persian language and literature.
I want people to know what he has written, because if you keep it in boxes, nobody would know. Maybe the language is not here anymore, but the language never dies. See, even now, some people are so interested in it. That's why we are getting a good response. And there is so much of culture in this language. There is so much of history about Kashmir as well in the language, because it's somehow connected with Iran.
Organizers say Darab's contribution to Persian literature in the valley is also highlighted in documentation of the greatest poets, Ghani Kashmiri. Munawar Zaman, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A resolution was recently presented to the UN General Assembly for the first time after the Taliban took over Afghanistan. While discussing issues including security, terrorism, and the social and economic situation, the Assembly significantly refrained to recognize the Taliban as a government. Experts believe this could affect the nation.
Non-recognition of the Taliban by the global community could negatively affect Afghanistan. It would bring illegitimacy to the Taliban government. It would also have consequences for the country's diplomatic relations, trade, and culture. There may even be more sanctions. These could have adverse effects on people, especially the poor.
In response to this resolution, Suhail Shaheen, the head of the political office of the Islamic Emirate in Qatar, said according to Islamic principles and values, the Taliban are committed to fulfilling all the legitimate rights and demands of the people, and that they are trying to provide the right means and environment to achieve this goal. Experts say the recognition of the Taliban could have positive results.
If the Taliban government is recognized after the observation of human rights and some other standards by the Taliban, it could have very good results for the nation, such as in the fields of international relations and international economic interactions.
Since the Taliban took control 15 months ago, their non-recognition, along with the sanctions imposed on the central bank and the freezing of Afghan assets, has driven the economy of the country to the brink of collapse. It is believed the recognition of Taliban may be a way to improve the situation in the country. But on the other hand, releasing assets and removing sanctions could also be effective. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On Monday, the European Union announced new sanctions on a number of Iranian officials and three organizations, including Iran's 24-hour English news channel, Press TV, for alleged crackdown on protests which began following the death of Mahsa Amini, a young Iranian woman who collapsed in police custody and was pronounced dead a few days later at hospital. The state broadcaster is accused of airing, quote, forced confessions of detainees, according to an EU statement. A baseless claim that has surprised Press TV staff and managers, as no such forced confessions have been produced or broadcast by the English-language news channel during the recent riots. On the contrary, the news channel has made a great effort to counter fake narratives fostered by Western media.
They make claims about Press TV producing and airing forced confessions. I've been working here at Press TV for almost a decade now, and I can tell you that Press TV has not aired any confessions whatsoever, forced or unforced. So that shows you how such decisions by the EU and the like are based on unfounded claims with no basis in reality. You know, I see this as part of their hybrid warfare against Iran. If you look at the big picture, you see them supporting terrorist groups. And these sanctions on Press TV I see as part of the media war and their narrative control. They want to present the war with their distorted version of what's going on in Iran these days, and seemingly they don't feel much comfortable with Press TV challenging their narrative. So they would try everything to silence us or make us less heard, but we're not going to be silenced.
Riots broke out in Iran in mid-September after the death of Mahsa Amini. Rioters brutally attacked security officers and caused massive damage to public property. Iran's intelligence ministry has revealed that the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the unrest, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Israeli regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. Experts believe that sanctions imposed on Press TV by the EU and earlier by the government of Canada are aimed at muzzling free speech and alternative views. And once again, the term human rights violations has turned into a tool for Western countries to advance their own agenda, as street riots in Iran don't seem to be achieving the goals they expected. Taking into consideration all the different aspects, Press TV is not discouraged by the unfair treatment and false accusations.
Despite all obstacles, Press TV will continue to be the voice of the voiceless, reporting underreported stories and news overlooked by mainstream media. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
When there's mutual trust, a deal is a deal. It's this easy to arrive at an agreement when the two sides of the bargain are from Russia and Iran. These B2B meetings come as part of an economic forum held in Tehran between Iranian businesses and over 100 companies from Russia.
We're a Russian logistic company, and we're here to participate in this business forum to find some partners for business with Iran. We are thinking to transport goods to Iran, from Iran, through Iran.
Our activity is about gas, oil, petrochemical equipment, machinery, instrument. We can export many items to Russian companies. For example, as the machinery, as raw material, and it can help both sides to develop their business relationship as soon as possible.
Tehran and Moscow's interests coincide on many fronts. Both are faced with U.S. sanctions, and both are signatories to the 2015 deal, which has faced troubles following the U.S. withdrawal from the pact in 2018 and the reinstatement of sanctions on Iran. While the bans have adversely affected the Russo-Iranian trade, businessmen here believe there's a strong will from both Tehran and Moscow to overcome those restrictions.
I don't think it will be like a very, very big problem for our countries. Yes, we have a border, we have a Caspian Sea, and we can transport cargo. This sanction, it is some problem for the trading, for the money transferring, but it's okay for logistics, no problem.
The American measures have complicated the Russian-Iranian commercial ties when it comes to money transfer and banking transactions. While alternatives, such as the use of national currencies, have already paid off, legal experts attending this forum say they have a better way out. Cryptocurrency.
Using cryptocurrencies, Iran and Moscow can effectively ditch the U.S. dollar. So if the two sides include this transaction method in their contracts, they can proceed with their businesses seamlessly without any concern over the impacts of U.S. measures.
Visits between Iranian and Russian officials have in recent months increased, following the West tightening its economic measures against both countries. Tehran and Moscow are now eyeing its one-year strategic partnership treaty that would lay out the roadmap for future expansion of ties at all levels, from politics to economy and security.
This year, Tehran and Russia traded some $4 billion worth of commodities, roughly 90% up compared to last year's trade volume. Now, given the growing relationship between the two sides, the Iran-Russia Chamber of Commerce predicts that this figure will hit $10 billion by 2024. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The real image of the United States of America, or as the journal Economist called the disunited States of America, is seen on the sidewalks of Los Angeles or San Francisco, which are brimmed over with tens of homeless people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Counterpunch wrote, "One of the six dangerous promises made by Trump should be regain the White House is his plan to deport homeless people from urban centers to tent cities on the periphery. Another word for tent cities is concentration camps. As anyone with a brain can deduce, a Trump team might very well not stop with packing off the homeless to concentration camps. Next could come Black Lives Matter protesters, anyone accused of being Antifa, then all leftists in general, then immigrants. You get the picture. Arranging for forced relocation to tent cities is a slippery slope in fascist hell. Even if it is limited only to the unhoused, it would be an execrable violation of their human rights. So it is to be opposed on all counts. Even more so considering we have available housing for homeless people right now. Just in San Francisco, there are 10 houses sitting empty for every one person sleeping on the street," a San Francisco District 5 supervisor Dean Preston tweeted on October 13th. "We have the housing, but the homeless can't pay for it. Hello, what about nationalizing it? Or less radically, the government could purchase it at a reasonable rate and then give people who needed shelter. But that involves ditching capitalist shibboleths, and the U.S. rulers are extremely rigid about those." It's time to instill some flexibility in elites, not only regarding housing but also with food. Worldwide, plenty of food is produced, enough to feed everyone. It's just that unfortunate economic and political arrangement dispossessed so many billions that many of them can't afford it. As a result, hundreds of millions of people don't get enough calories each day. That's easy to fix. You just have to decide to do it. And that requires not being a blind capitalist ideologue. In the US, Americans have the novel and uniquely widespread phenomenon of homelessness. People who live in their cars. But with the skyrocketing price of gas, thanks to Biden's idiotic Russia sanctions to bolster his Ukraine proxy war infamy, these poor folk may soon have to trade down from their sedan to a sleeping bag on a city sidewalk. If they do that, they will incur the wrath of the affluent, who consider them a blight on neighborhoods that could otherwise sport eaters with $10 coffees and $30 sandwiches, or expensive gyms, or any other of the commercial ornaments of the districts of the rich. So, not surprisingly, Trump's plan for 10 cities is widely approved on the political right in the U.S. The homeless are so unsightly, you see. Their misery is supposedly their own fault, because they allegedly use drugs and are often falsely accused of not wanting to work. Rightists skip over the inconvenient fact that many, maybe even most of the people sleeping in their cars do work, like whole armies of adjunct professors, but they get paid so pitifully that they can't afford shelter. Or right-wingers become hysterical about homeless, being mentally ill, well, provide care. That's not complicated, however, it does cost money. But it's easier to scream that vagabonds are nuts, the implication being dangerous. The equation of mental illness with violence is a pernicious lie, because the most lethal Americans are gun owners, and very few crazy people own guns. They're too busy trying to cope and survive the agony of cohabiting with their internal demons. Whatever the excuse, the wealthy, along with Trump's rabidly fascistic base, which includes many of the nation's police, want the homeless to scram. They want to reclaim U.S. cities are the playgrounds for the rich that they think they were meant to be. Some of the homeless use drugs. Some doubtless sell small quantities of them. A homeless drug dealer? That would be a tougher for the radical right. Vagabond drug dealers, no doubt, would require separate tent camps. They might even get their tent cities blatantly repurposed as death camps. And what starts as an exception for a pariah caste could soon become the norm for the larger group, because when dealing with such a big problem, reactionaries may soon conclude that nothing small will do. After all, there are lots of homeless people in the U.S., officially 500,000, though that statistic is belied by another from the National Center on Family Homelessness, which says 2.5 million children are homeless each year in America. So they have, at a minimum, 3 million unhoused souls in America. Just from casual observation of city life and from the sordid abuse of statistics by American officialdom, is that they have more than 3 million homeless people, maybe millions more. But that's just a hunch based on another manipulated statistic, namely the unemployment one. since unemployment stats diabolically delete the throng of long-term unemployed people who have given up looking for work, the question naturally arises, how do they live? How do these uncounted jobless, perhaps millions of them, pay rent with no income? Well, they probably don't. There is no charge for sleeping under the stars, and that's about all you can afford it if you are unemployed for years. True, you run the risk of getting beaten up by the police or dying of exposure. And if Trump is re-elected, you could be shipped off to a tent city where the first question to arise is, how will you eat? But if you are one of the droves of unnumbered, invisible people who have been unemployed for years, this miserable calculus is all old hat. After all, food and shelter are luxuries for millions of Americans who have been trained by the rigors of austere capitalism to do without the latter and skimp, to put it mildly, on the former. To Trump and his fellow fascists on the GOP right, homeless people are dangerous and deranged. Yet, according to Invisible People, a group that supports the unhoused, homeless people are murdered at a rate 25 times higher than those who have a residence. Indeed, 640 homeless deaths took place in the streets of New York City in 2022 alone. But the homeless are far more likely to be portrayed as perpetrators. That's because they are depicted as a not like us. They are not neat and clean. They don't get to shower every day or sleep in a bed. All these features of vagabondage set off alarm bells on the political right, and they affront the class snobbery of the well-to-do. No fixed address. Little bathing. Clearly, these people must be psychotic and threatening. Clearly, they belong out of sight in tent camps. Clearly, respectable people should not be asked to feed them when they are confined in those camps, because clearly, they don't have much right to life. They forfeited that when they committed the offense called poverty. The website of Hill wrote, the typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of as a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S., are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless, nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They're frequently overlooked in the debate on how politicians solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's leader has said that Washington has always been at the forefront of the anti-Iran campaign, and its European allies are standing behind it. He further added that all U.S. presidents have gone up against Iran in the years following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution and have relied on the support of the Israeli regime and certain regimes in the region to accomplish their so-called goals. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Iran's enemies have done that, especially through extensive media facilities such as satellite networks, virtual space, and mercenary TV channels. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Kevin Bedert, editor at Veterans Today, joins us from Madison. Also joining us is Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. If I may first start with you, Kevin Bedert, and taking a look at Iran's leader's statement. Well, he has said many, but the one that's, I think, set the stage for this discussion is how he has stressed that Washington has always been at the forefront of the anti-Iran campaign, and then the European allies actually follow and stand behind the U.S. Do you agree with Iran's leader there?
Absolutely. It's just a historical fact. If we go back to the 1953 coup d'etat, the British wanted their oil company bailed out. The Americans at that time were still almost junior partners, but they did spearhead the coup by hiring gangsters like Brainless Shaban and Icy Ramadan to bring rent-a-mobs into the streets and provide cover for the overthrow of Prime Minister Mossadegh. And now things have evolved. Of course, the Americans are now fully in charge of the world. They're totally humiliating the Europeans with their war on Europe. It's supposed to be a war on Russia, but it's basically depriving Europe of energy and financial clout. And in Iran, the Americans are probably the biggest force, along with their partners, the Israelis, who actually own U.S. Mideast policy, in terms of trying to mount one of these regime change operations in which they stir up violence and chaos and then try to use that to overthrow the government. And of course, the CIA has overthrown many dozens of governments around the world, and they've tried to overthrow even more. And in Iran, they've tried a number of coups since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, and they've always failed. And this one's probably going to fail again, inshallah. It certainly looks like it's failing. If you look at the real news sources about what's going on in Iran, what they've succeeded in doing, however, is creating a mainstream media facade in the West, which Westerners only get this stage-managed feed of nonsense about what is supposedly happening in Iran. But I think it's some simulacrum of Iran that they must have built on another planet or a Disney World stage or something. So that in their own minds, in their own fantasy, they're succeeding in overthrowing the government of Iran. But in the real world, they're making more and more Iranians hate them as they make allies of the MEK, this horrific terrorist group, and then they spend money to hire thugs to run around committing violence in Iran. This is not the way to win the hearts and minds of the Iranian people. The Americans are really an incompetent empire, and the way that they approach this trying to control governments around the world is so often counterproductive, and it backfires. And at the end of the day, this is probably going to just cost even more soft power and legitimacy to the U.S. They're throwing away their good name on these stupid adventures that only play well in their own media.
Well, Mohsen Abbas, when you want to take a look at the strategy that's being used, it seems like it's a multi-pronged strategy that's being executed by the U.S. and then its allies. Of course, the Europeans are part of that, because we're taking a look at the different pressures that are being exerted on Iran from almost all directions, from the media, from the IAEA, from the Human Rights Council, and then you have the sanctions, and then you have this, you have that. I mean, it just keeps piling up. And this was usually done not in such short intervals, but the timing between them was a bit longer. But it seems like they're throwing it all in. At least that's one way of looking at it. Why do you think they're doing that all at once in the form and manner that they are?
I think they feel that time is running out. I think the developing relations between Russia and Iran, between China and Iran, and just this general looming threat of the Eurasian axis is one major reason for accelerating this whole business. Because, of course, de-dollarization, the talk of breaking away from the American hegemony in general, economically speaking, around the world has been starting to gain currency. And, of course, the exposure of the Americans' military frailties has been self-evident across West Asia. And Syria proved it. Iraq proved it. In Lebanon, Hezbollah have proved it. The Yemenis have proved it against Saudi Arabia. Virtually every theater of military or hard power that the Americans have been throwing their weight around behind, Israel, of course, included, they pretty much failed. For the size and the sheer power and scale of military strength that they have literally failed to make Iran basically give away its sovereignty, to stop fighting for the oppressed in the regions, to stop struggling and to maintain its independence. In every theater of war against the axis of resistance led by the Islamic Republic of Iran, hard power has failed. So they've turned increasingly to what I would describe as smart power. What you've described a whole range of multiple attacks, and they've done it through the economic sanctions, so-called maximum pressure. That's backfired on them because the Iranians have just been forced to become even more self-sufficient. And with their concentration on the scientific and technological advancement, especially in the military field, there's been a huge and rapid increase of Iranian power in that regard. So the hard power and, if you like, this kind of soft power of economy or the soft power of cultural psyops, which they've been engaging in, even that is ultimately failing, although they put all of their, I think, their eggs in that basket more or less now, having failed with ISIS. The last gambit in terms of hard power I can ascertain was really to use ISIS in the region. And when that failed in Iraq, the idea of taking over Iraq, breaking Iran's kind of regional policy and its access to Israel through Iraq via Syria into Lebanon and then, of course, into Israel, that pretty much failed after the Syrian war and also the Iraqi war, where ISIS were used as a way of trying to break Iran's kind of hold. Right. So they've turned increasingly desperately now into just pressing all the buttons. It seems as though everything from the ISIS terrorists to the MKO terrorists to the Al-Jundullah terrorists, combined with their sleeper cells who are on the ground in Iran, ex-Shah supporters, people disgruntled from the 2-day party in the past, and those who hate the Islamic Revolution and just hate the Iranian establishment for the sake of it. All of these groups have been working quietly as if you like, agents of Zio-American imperialism. And okay, Now they've been unleashed at once.
Well, one of the things that's very interesting, and I think maybe some may miss this point because they're not really looking at the way that Iran has actually advanced, and that is its advancement when it comes to different fields in terms of technology, industry, or what have you. Because Kevin Barrett, as we know, when a country stands on its own 2 feet, and that's a result of sanctions, actually, that Iran has been able to do that in order to advance its domestic production, for example. And that also is something that Iran's leader has said bothers the U.S. For example, if you want to take a look at Saudi Arabia, I don't even know if they can produce a light bulb. But, you know, you have Iran that's manufacturing things on a vast array of items and materials, what have you. Why do you think that is important and how that has actually angered the U.S.?
Well, that's in some ways really the key to the situation. These sanctions have actually had the same effect as in tariffs would have. If Iran had wanted to build up its own industries, it could have imposed tariffs and decreased its imports and then been forced to make its own stuff. And apparently the Americans have decided to do that for them. And it's worked out reasonably well for Iran, considering. I mean, of course, there are plenty of hardships associated with these sanctions, but then there are also these hidden benefits. And Iran has become a technological powerhouse and a manufacturing powerhouse by comparison with most other countries in the region. And that has driven the Americans crazy because their model for the so-called developing world, which is they want to keep them in a sort of third world impoverished conditions by getting them into deep debt, and that debt with the ever-increasing exponential interest essentially enslaves these countries and forces them to mortgage their real productive forces, whether it's natural resources or human resources, and put those at the service of the international bankers. It's a banking cartel. John Perkins described this in Confessions of an Economic Hitman, how the U.S. empire is the first empire whose first weapon has been usury, and only its second weapon has been military force. So Iran has beaten the United States by getting out from under its usury and becoming self-sufficient. And technologically, Iran has done amazing things. It is putting satellites into space. It's building military defenses that are extremely powerful and a strong deterrent against direct military attack. It can now hit Israel with overwhelming firepower of missiles. It can do the same thing to U.S. military bases in the region. It can threaten U.S. ships in the region. So Iran, with its technological prowess and its increasing ability to manufacture things like automobiles and all kinds of goods that it has been sanctioned against importing, has thrived. Considering the situation, at least compared to the other countries in the region, Iran looks like a success story, and that really hurts the Americans because it hurts their ability to continue to try to corral the whole world into their empire. And okay. So that's why we've had this endless war. And I think the other guest was exactly right. Right now, we're seeing a movement towards a new Eurasian axis, as most of the world has not got along with the sanctions on Russia and increasingly is finding alternatives to sanctions on Iran as well. Iran was brought into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and one day later, this destabilization campaign broke out. Obviously not a coincidence. So yeah, they're throwing everything they have at Iran right now, but they don't have that much left. And when this fails, as it will, we're going to be left with a fully sovereign Iran, really in some ways the most sovereign nation in the world at this point, which will be a light unto the other nations, especially in the region, right, as the world shifts into a multipolar orientation.
So gathering the statements from both of you here, Seymour and Abbas, because you've both indicated this, because we're looking at this shift that's taking place, and Iran has made it clear through the cooperation agreements that it has signed, like with Russia and then with China, and it's going through this shift, not just Iran, the world is really shifting towards the east, that the U.S. is realizing that. And Seymour and Abbas, you talked about the dollar. And there's an interesting notion out there that I'd like to find out from you, where when the U.S. sees that a country does not want to trade or use the dollar in terms of its denomination or have its currency to be based on that, that is a signal for that country to be either targeted or for it to be attacked, as we have seen other countries to be a victim of that. Is that a correct assumption or a correct theory to look at?
I think it's a very critical point for people to get the real context of global politics, geopolitics on an international scale. You see, it is, of course, about rivalry between states, but it's about more than that. The American establishment, really, in terms of its military, is the boots on the ground, not for the American citizens or the American people. It's the boots on the ground for the money mafia, money power. Essentially, it is the boots on the ground which guarantees that money powers hold, or the money mafia, or the with the other institutions like the World Bank, or the International Monetary Fund, or the World Trade Organizations, for the matter. All of these financial institutions, which are overseeing the wreckage of most of the poor countries of the world and making sure they strangle any kind of independence or economic sustainability of these countries, is really, it has to have some kind of way of policing those nations that don't comply with the world money power order. So Iran is one of the primary forces. I believe that Iran is still not, it may be one of the only nations, perhaps alongside Venezuela, that isn't subject to the Bank of International Settlements and the World Bank in general. It doesn't fully comply with that, although it's still part of the global usurious mechanism that's out there. The truth is that Iran has stood against that and isn't fully subjugated to that system. That is probably one of the biggest reasons why they've gone after Iran, because they cannot have anybody outside of their mechanism and their system. Because once you have the World Bank throttling you with their clauses and forcing you to behave in the way they want economically, it invariably means that actually you're going to give away all your country's resources. And that's what they do. They use the American military or their proxy terrorists, whether it's ISIS or MKO or others around the world, in order to enforce their rape of the commons, the taking of the wealth and the resources of virtually the whole planet, actually. But actually, Iran is standing against that, and as a result, it has to expect money power, not just America, but actually the whole of the Atlantic powers and the whole of the Anglo-Zionist empire. It has to expect its full wrath, and that's what it's facing. And it's done, I have to say, rather admirably against all the odds to stand against that power. The Iranian people, of course, on the ground will suffer. As an oil-rich nation, of course, they could compare themselves to the likes of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, who've bent over backwards for that empire. And yes, on the surface, Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait have high, high economic wealth per person. But you see, what's the reality is that those nations, within a matter of a decade, at the most, maybe a couple of decades, will run out of oil, and they will run out of the patronage of money power, and they will become destitute nations. They will have nothing. And Iran, in the long run, it may suffer in the short run with the policies it's doing, but its independence and autonomy in the long run will serve the Iranian people very well, because they will stand tall and be independent and wealthy, I would believe.
Well, what we're witnessing at this point when it comes to the developments on the ground, so to speak, Kevin Barrett, is an interpretation by many Iranian security personnel that say we're entering, or we have entered, the armed phase of this anti-Iran action that's being executed. And this especially has shown itself in the past 3 days, where we've unfortunately had some of these terrorists conduct their operations and take the lives of some of our security personnel. Is this also part of this, which, well, the Iran's intelligence ministries have said that the CIA, along with Israel's intelligence agency, and also the UK, MI6, to be involved in executing this. Are we looking at that as also a way of this armed phase to now be in the fore? And how do you see that panning out?
Yes, well, I think there's been that element of violence from the beginning, as the CIA, Mossad, Axis, as they arranged for the unrest as a cover for the violence, as they always do. Just like in Kiev, they brought people into Maidan Square, and then they had their snipers fire at both sides to get people fighting and to destabilize that situation or create a civil war, which they did. And just as they did the same thing in Syria, that's what they're trying to get going in Iran. But the violence does seem to be escalating, and the huge marches in support of the Islamic Republic, which are not being reported in the West, but which those of us who have access to Twitter and find the right Twitter feeds can see with our own eyes, it shows that, you know, what we have here is this minority of terrorists who are perfectly willing to work with the MKO, which has been public enemy number one in Iran for 99% of the people of Iran for decades, in just these gratuitous attacks. Those people are obviously trained and armed and supported and goaded on by the CIA and similar services, perhaps from other countries, especially Israel.
All right. Last question goes to you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. There was a funeral procession that was held in the Iranian city of Mashhad today. And there were really, it was quite incredible, not only in terms of the numbers, tens of thousands, if not more, had shown up. And also just the scenes that then when the sun went down and people were still out there, where any of the demos or protests, so-called protests that I should say, happening otherwise in Iranian streets failed completely, it failed pale compared to what has happened. Iran's leaders said that they're trying to give the impression that there are large numbers of people that are opposed to the Islamic establishment. Isn't that something to be looked at?
Well, certainly the Western media doesn't want anybody to look at that. The propaganda and the fake news and the whole exaggeration that's going on over here. If you were to read Western press and media, honestly, it would drive you crazy. You'd think, as Kevin had said earlier on in his initial comment, you'd think you're living on a parallel planet. The truth is that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israelis, had made it clear that they weren't going to tolerate Iran becoming so technologically powerful that it could make nuclear weapons, that it could go completely independent in every way, shape, or form. And it's not just, of course, Israel wanting that because they want to dominate the region. It's also because actually what Ayatollah Khomeini has lit as a torch in Iran is hugely dangerous for an ideology called neoliberalism, which we all know very well. And indeed, this is not just about the Iranian sovereignty. It's about values. It's about what values humanity has. And Iran has some which are based in prophetic ideals.
Thank you.
I think that serves the West too.
Thank you so much, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Kevin Barrett, thank you, editor at Veterans Today. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwei and the team, it's goodbye. We'll be right back.